Hey, thanks everyone for being here. My name is Matthias. I'm on the Social Justice Committee. So four of us are here today to talk to you about social justice work we've done. There's a very wide spectrum. One of them was going to be Betty Hathaway, who for a few of you probably don't know, was a pillar of our community that we lost just a few weeks back. So Donna Amos will be with us to read what she had prepared. So first I'm going to invite up
Judy Cirillo
to talk about her work with immigrants and refugees.
Hello, I'm Judy Cirillo. I'm ashamed to say I forgot my hearing aids today, so if I seem a little blah, you'll know why. I can still speak. What I'm talking about, we have the Immigration Committee, which we started this year around October, and it's new and we're working on it, but it's wonderful that there's so much work being done in Portland on the subject of immigration and helping immigrants. When I was a little girl, really a preschooler, I remember listening with my mother to the radio. I don't remember what was said on the radio or even if I understood it at the time. What I remember is my mother very upset about what was happening in Germany under Hitler. We were Jews, and the Jews in Europe were going to concentration camps, starving, freezing, being separated from their families, suffering untold miseries while the world watched. It was more years before the Allies got into the war and finally stopped Hitler. I am involved with our immigration committee because I remember the terror of that time and feel that it may be upon us again. I may be exaggerating, but our present situation in parts in the U.S. is equally frightening. Moreover, there are now refugees from Syria, Africa, and many countries, parts of the world who are once again homeless, being separated from their families, and needing the world to speak up for them and help them. We have learned that there are three groups in Portland bringing refugees into our country. They are Catholic Charities, Lutheran Community Services, and SOAR, which is the letters stand for Sponsors Organized to Assist Refugees, and it's under the World Church Services. SOAR is an ecumenical group. While we can't at this time bring refugees in directly, we can help by assisting with education for adults and children, helping with assimilation by teaching people to shop, use the public transportation system, get the services they need, and generally being friends and supporters to these families. They are alone, away from their culture and everything they have known, in need of friendship and support in their new lives. Fortunately, there are many good people in the Portland area who are helping in many ways. We can't do this alone, but with the help of Emerge, and Emerge stands for Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, as well as Catholic Charities, ERCO, and other groups, we can make a difference. Emerge meets monthly on Tuesdays. They don't provide direct services, but they really educate us and teach us how we can help. They meet on the second Tuesday of the month, and the next meeting is February 14th. It's 6:30 to 8:30, and it's right near us at St. Michael's and All Angels Episcopal Church on Northeast 43rd Avenue. I've learned a lot while attending their meetings. They have recently started a sanctuary movement for immigrants and refugees in danger of being harassed by ICE and deported. There are many ways we can get involved and make a difference. We have done some research and are beginning to reach out to refugees to provide the help and friendship they need. If you would like to get involved in this endeavor, I have names of organizations you can contact and do your bit, big or small. And believe me, it doesn't have to be big. It could be just an hour or two each week to start with. When we do for others, the rewards to us, as you probably know, are many. Please see me if you would like more information to see where you can fit in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm doing this for Betty and Hay.
Okay, in 1980, Medicare had existed for 15 years. It remains immensely popular. Despite its popularity, Medicare's shortcomings had been noticed. So private insurance companies had jumped in and offered a myriad of different plans to fill the gaps in Medicare. During the 1980s, things were changing. Medical costs were skyrocketing. Medicare asks the patient to cover a percentage of the cost of medical benefits. So patient expenses were also skyrocketing. Another change taking place in the 80s was that women were joining the workforce in droves, so their available time to help care for aging parents and to help them with important decisions like which supplemental private insurance plan to take was diminishing. With a confusing array of private supplements, deceptive marketing practices, and less family help, dissatisfaction was building among Medicare recipients. Members of Congress were getting lots of phone calls for them. One of the first actions that Congress sought was to offer impartial consultants to help Medicare recipients. When priced out, they could not afford to hire enough government employees to be impartial consultants. So in 1990, they authorized a program that is facilitated with host agencies and volunteers. Federal, state, and local employees provide expertise and training for thousands of volunteers. Volunteers provide a free and confidential service that helps everyone make informed decisions about Medicare and related insurance. Oregon's implementation of the program is called SHIBA, Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance. Hank and Betty have been volunteering with this program for 9 years. Medicare rules are frequently being changed, and volunteers are constantly enhancing their knowledge. State and county laws, as well as the Affordable Care Act, also had impact on Medicare recipients. So part of their responsibility is to keep up with the changes. The majority of their clients are struggling with decision. What is the difference between having Medicare and drug plan, adding a supplemental plan, or taking Medicare Advantage plan instead of using basic Medicare? Is my employer's retiree health plan a better choice than these? There are 21 drug plans and 20 Medicare Advantage plans available to folks in Multnomah County. Which one or one will be the best options for me? Has a drug plan or Medicare Advantage plan changed in what it does and who it covers? Will my medical providers still be covered? These are challenging decisions. The volunteers screen plans for Medicare recipients, check out who covers the drugs and how well and through which pharmacy, find out the insurance coverage, their doctors, some won't take Medicare, some will only take Medicare Advantage plans. They also talk to the clients about medical organizations that they like, that they don't like. In the end, they were usually able to narrow down the client choices to only a few. The needs of their clients often extends past the boundaries of Medicare. Am I eligible for any government assistance in paying for Medicare? Can I get charity assistance from a local medical organization like Providence or OHSU? Is there any other help for my prescription drugs? I can't afford them. The floor is collapsing in my bathroom, in my mobile home. How can I get it fixed? I don't have any money. I don't understand my bill. I can't pay. I am being taken to collections. These are some of the cases that are particularly memorable, and here are a couple. A young man who spoke broken English came into the office. He lives in Eastern Oregon and is getting dialysis for his failed kidneys 3 days a week at a nearby facility. His assistance program had ended and the dialysis center was billing him $65 a treatment. It was 58 days after his change in status. We knew immediately that he only had 63 days to get a supplemental plan according to Medicare rules. The supplement would cost him roughly $140 a month on top of his $105 medical premium and drug plan. He had been an agriculture worker and had very little money. But we knew that that if we could get him a supplement and drug plan within the 63-day window of opportunity, the American Kidney Foundation would pick up the cost of his plan and many of his drugs. Furthermore, this young man would be eligible for a kidney transplant that would extend his life and improve his quality of life and eventually offer him the help that would allow him to work again. They contacted the Dialysis Center social worker to confirm that she was ready to jump on the Kidney Foundation program as soon as he completed the paperwork. They enrolled him in a drug plan and then contacted the Oregon State SHIBA coordinators to alert them to the situation. Supplemental insurance has to be bought through an insurance agent, so they found one and spoke to a good agent. But the client's poor English and fuzzy-headedness due to the toxins in his blood became a big problem. He submitted his application for supplement, but it was after the 63-day deadline. His application was denied. They called the Oregon State Insurance Commission, explained the situation, then filed an appeal on his behalf. Fortunately, they had thought to ask the insurance agent to purchase a plan from a large insurer in Oregon. Large insurers have specialists in dealing with state insurance commissions. The insurance commission pleaded his case with a specialist and also gave them an opportunity to plead the case with the client in the room. The specialist gave the client a stern rebuke, but allowed him to get the supplemental plan. The social worker at the dialysis center was able to submit the application to the supplemental, to supplement what he paid for. Another case involved a sweet lady in her mid-70s who uses OHSU as her medical home. She had Medicare Advantage plan that was fairly good coverage, but it had no premium when she first signed up for it and co-pays were low. Unfortunately, she wasn't one that watched her mail closely. When the Medicare Advantage plan sent her a notice that she would have to pay monthly premiums and deductibles and have higher co-pays, she did not pay attention. When she came to our office, she was several months behind in paying her premiums and could not afford the co-pays for her medical appointments and procedures. She was avoiding her doctor's requests for tests because she couldn't afford them, even though she felt bad and knew something was wrong. They were able to contact OHSU's financial assistance office on her behalf and find out that if she dropped Medicare Advantage plan and simply had Medicare plus a drug plan, they would be able to offer her full financial assistance. Why? Because her income was so low that the state of Oregon was paying her Medicare premiums. They were able to contact the customer service supervisor for her Medicare Advantage plan and have her disenrolled in the beginning of the following month and allow her to pay as little as $5 a month to make up for her past due premiums. They talked to the billing office at OHSU and got assistance with her past due bills at OHSU that would be forgiven once the paperwork had moved through their system. They also enrolled her in a drug plan. While these cases are not typical, they are memorable, and they are what kept Betty and Hank going back each week to try and help others.
I just want to say I work on a county resource line that's really closely affiliated with SHIBA, and Betty's loss has been felt really keenly in that world as well. Seeing a lot of the emails going back and forth. So let me just preface this with a reminder I picked up from blogger Myra Kurzer in a recent post called, quote, "How to hashtag stay outraged without losing your minds." Kurzer encourages us that to be effective in any area and avoid losing our minds, we must individually, not collectively, pick one or two issues and let go of the rest. This doesn't mean we don't still support those working on other issues and show up where we can, just that we should only feel responsible for taking leadership in a couple select areas that fire us up the most. The corollary to this is that we don't undermine other people's issues. Everybody focuses where they feel most moved to focus, and that way everything, theoretically, gets covered. As somebody who grapples with the feeling of being responsible for single-handedly fixing the entire world, the above advice really resonates. At the same time, being moved to action is an intense place to be. It's not quite as simple as, I like bowling, you like collecting stamps, we've all got our preferences. We're talking about deep moral imperatives, issues of life and death. Each of us has our own story that determines what moves us most, and it takes a real capacity for healthy boundary setting and assertive communication to respect that we all have different lanes, while also speaking our own truth about why we think action is urgently needed in a specific area. Indeed, part of moving beyond passive response and taking leadership on an issue is trying to convince others to devote their precious time and energy to advocating for it. So as I conclude this lengthy preface, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what most compassions mean and why. I got involved in the fight against big money corruption back in 2014 in San Francisco. As a fairly privileged white guy, I had the dubious but real luxury, since my political awakening of a few years prior, of being insulated enough from the direct impacts of any one area of corruption and injustice to be able to read about and get stressed out about all of them. I showed up for an event called the March Against Corruption and was excited as I marched up Market Street with just about 50 other folks at a unified analysis of big money corruption as we chanted, "How do we get single-payer health care? How do we end the wars? How do we stop climate change?" The answer was always the same: money out of politics. The group that organized this action, 99 Rides, was a scrappy grassroots upstart founded by social movement researchers looking to apply the lessons of the dozens of successful movements that have arisen around the world in the last century to affect real and lasting change here in the US. I had dabbled in activism, but always felt like I was doing little more than just showing up to style my conscience, merely because doing nothing was the only alternative. So it blew my mind to meet people that had an actual, empirically informed plan and the expectation to apply that plan and win. The next planned action was a 480-mile march from LA to Sacramento, evoking the Delano to Sacramento March of the United Farm Workers, followed by a series of sit-ins in the state capitol to push several pieces of legislation to mandate disclosure of political spending and advance the cause for a constitutional amendment to overturn the disastrous Citizens United decisions of 2010. Joining up with the last grueling week of this march was my anointment into many things. The realization that there was actual empirical research on social movements, an understanding of how discipline and escalating nonviolent action served the strategic goal of mobilizing the critical mass of active popular support necessary for movement success, and a sense of responsibility to, whether it felt comfortable or not, step up and take some leadership. There's plenty more to tell and little time to do so, but as many of you know, we replicated this model on a national level in April of last year with a historic march from Philadelphia to DC and a week of sit-ins in which over 1,300 people from labor, environmental, student, racial justice, and elders groups were arrested on the steps of the Capitol. Key to our agenda was not just the big money corruption enshrined by Citizens United, but also the complementary trend toward rampant racist voter suppression nationwide, the former amplifying the voices of a tiny minority at the top, and the latter silencing those of the most marginalized groups in our society. The 2016 presidential election was exceptional in many ways. One that warrants more attention than it has been receiving is that it was the first presidential election in over half a century without the full protections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The implications have been immense. 2013 Supreme Court decision in Shelby County versus Holder eliminated Section 5 of the Act, also known as the Preclearance Clause. Section 5 required a series of states, counties, and townships with histories of Jim Crow discrimination to submit all new changes to election law to the federal government for review so that blatantly discriminatory regulations could be blocked before going into effect. Prior to 1965, African American voters were all but denied the franchise in many parts of this country by barriers including poll taxes and virtually unpassable literacy tests, dramatized really well in the movie Selma, that were applied selectively to African American citizens as a prerequisite for registration. Since Shelby County, a new rash of voter suppression laws and policies have proliferated nationwide, including many of the same states that were the initial targets of the Voting Rights Act. With a thinly veiled pretext of preventing the specter of voter fraud, many states have passed voter ID laws that systematically target low-income people and communities of color while cutting down on early voting and same-day registration and closing close to 900 polling stations between 2012 and 2016. An appeals court decision described a North Carolina law that included all these tactics as targeting African-American voters with, quote, almost surgical precision. Not content to merely make voting harder or block registration, crusaders against voter fraud have also pushed successfully in many states for mass purges to existing voter rolls via a system called interstate cross-check. In states that use the system, 1 in 6 Latinos, 1 in 7 Asian Americans, and 1 in 9 African Americans end up on the list through a process that has been clearly demonstrated to incorporate egregious biases. Those who are flagged receive a, quote, colorless postcard with small text and have to return the card in order to preserve their registration status, a procedural step that itself privileges older, wealthier, and whiter voters with more stable residency. While it's impossible to determine exactly how many fewer people voted in 2016 as a result of voter suppression, we do have some telling numbers. The American's Prospect reports that in heavily African-American Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 41,000 fewer people went to the polls than in 2012. In the past 5 years, over 2 million voters have emerged from the rolls in Ohio, a state that Donald Trump won by 447,000 votes. Yet in some states, a countervailing trend has begun to take hold, a trend toward breaking down barriers to ballot access. In 2015, the Oregon legislature passed what is commonly known as the Motor Voter Law, which in the month leading up to the 2016 presidential election automatically registered 225,000 people solely by virtue of their interaction with the DMV. Oregon's law has been lauded as a success, with 43%, about 100,000, of those registered under the law proceeding to vote in the 2016 election. Since Oregon's law was passed, California, Connecticut, West Virginia, Alaska, and Vermont have asked similar measures. Critically, the measures in West Virginia, Vermont, and Alaska were passed with support across party lines. In the case of Alaska, by a referendum that passed with 65% support. At the federal level, momentum has also been building. In the wake of Democracy Spring's mass civil disobedience action last April that I just told you about, Maryland's Representative Sarbanes issued a letter calling for hearings on Cicilline's Automatic Voter Registration Act and four other bills that would have reversed Shelby County versus Holder, allowed for same-day registration, early registration for youth, and overturned Citizens United. The letter was signed by over 100 members of Congress. Representative Brady of Pennsylvania's Automatic Voter Registration Act of 2016 contained the same provision that was detailed in Cicilline's 2015 bill. Yet it went further by expanding the number of institutions that could register more voters and providing for federal grants to assist states with implementation. Trump's repetition of long discredited lies about voter fraud and his recent call for an investigation indicate that his administration may double down on racist voter suppression laws. Yet even among Republican ranks, there have been dissent and distancing from these outrageous claims, even from the likes of Newt Gingrich. The bipartisan victories in Alaska, West Virginia, and Vermont show that despite the manipulation of the narrative for partisan ends, voting rights legislation still has potential to win support from both sides of the aisle, as long as we work to lift up a positive narrative centered on basic civil rights. We have already secured a commitment from Representative Brady's office to reintroduce the Automatic Voter Registration Act, and from Representative Blumenauer to reintroduce his Vote by Mail Act. And our next step is to build our network to enable us to effectively communicate to nearby Republican representatives like Eastern Oregon's Greg Walden and Southwest Washington's Jamie Herrera Butler, that standing on the side of voter suppression, of mass disenfranchisement, will have real and significant impact on their electoral prospects. Talk to me later if you want to be part of this work. And now, here's John reading some poetry about protecting water.
Hi. In December, we did an informal collection fundraiser for the Standing Rock water protectors. We raised $825.
Wow.
That was extraordinary. And we did not, let's put it this way, the next regular special collection we gave generously also. So we are a very generous people. I thought maybe in trying to keep with the energy of what we're looking for here, I'm gonna read from the poem that I wrote about Standing Rock and go from there. Actually, this is my presentation. When we tell the story of Standing Rock, we have to remember the 200 tribes that came, and the Maori, the Samoans, the Hawaiians, the Japanese, the Russians, the Germans, the Serbians, the Israelis, the Australians, and the off-reservation Americans. We could also mention a congregation to the far north that oriented and counseled protectors of every faith. No one questioned your right to be there. When the people tell the story of Standing Rock, it may be remembered that police used pepper spray and arrested and strip-searched women and men. We might mention Sophia, who almost lost her arm from a concussion grenade on Bridge 1806. It may not be remembered that policemen walked off their jobs. We will remember the people. They're not violent. When the people tell the story of Standing Rock, we'll include tales of fundraisers, church collections, gas money, bus fare. We could also note that there were enough winter clothes, blankets, and sleeping bags to stock thrift stores for miles in every direction. And we must tell you how everyone shared like we dream of sharing everywhere. When the people of Standing Rock, when the people tell the story of Standing Rock, we might mention the medical bus, the winterized teepees, the traditional kitchens. We'll remind investors that the Dakota Access Pipeline lost $20 million a week. Well, we thought about this. More important, everyone must know that the world was watching. Power flowed to indigenous people everywhere. When the people tell the story of Standing Rock, we'll likely remember the bulldozed sacred sites and the security guards with attack dogs. We'll say Obama eventually did the right thing, but we'll say it was the people in the camps that mattered, the people along the river that make sacred stones, the people who stood behind the people who tell this story to their grandchildren.
Thank you all, that was really good. And here's our closing hymn number one.